Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Each episode of Keep Calm and Cook On features a meaningful interview and answers to listeners' questions about cooking. Thank you to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools that I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Sarah Franklin is a writer and a teacher. She's an oral historian and a home cook. She teaches food culture and writing at both NYU and at the Wallkill Correctional Facility. She's also my friend and my kind of sort of neighbor. She lives with her husband, Chris, and their very adorable twin toddlers and their dog in Kingston, New York. Sarah's first book, Edna Lewis, At the Table with an American Original, came out last year. It's a collection of essays about Edna Lewis that Sarah pulled together from amazing people like Tony Tipton Martin, Michael Twitty, Caroline Randall Williams, Vivian Howard, and more. Before the book came out, Sarah finished her dissertation based on a series of oral history interviews she conducted with Judith Jones. Judith was the famous editor who worked not only with Edna Lewis, but also with Julia Child and so many more. She also, remarkably, took the diary of Anne Frank out of the reject pile. Sarah and I spoke at my house recently about three women: Edna Lewis, Judith Jones, and Sarah's own mother. Today's episode is all about how critical it is to celebrate the older women in our lives, to name their challenges out loud, and to listen to them when they share their stories. Thank you, Sarah, for sharing some of yours with all of us. Will you introduce yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Sarah Franklin.
Great.
What else do you want to know?
So I want to talk about three women who are in your life who are no longer here, but are very much here through your work and I think your memories, and Edna Lewis, Judith Jones, and your own mother.
Mm-hmm.
What was your mother's name?
She went by Cabby,
okay.
C-A-B-B-Y, because she hated her name, which was Carol Ann. She found it like super uptight and waspy, and she did in fact come from a pretty waspy family. So she went her whole life by her initials, Cab, and that turned into Cabby. A little bit of an oddball name for a little bit of an oddball woman.
I want to back up for anyone who might not know who Edna Lewis was.
Yeah.
How do you describe her?
I describe her as the most important figure in regional American cooking. And then there's all sort of many, many footnotes to that. So I think she's also one of the most important figures in African American cooking history. She's one of the most important figures in restaurant history. Mm-hmm. So she was born in rural Virginia in 1916. But by 1949, she was a full partner in a restaurant in New York City, which was really remarkable in and of itself. She became an author in her own right and published three cookbooks, three of her four, with Judith Jones at Knopf in the 70s, 80s, and then in the early aughts. Gosh, who else does she matter to? She's by many considered the kind of progenitor of the farm-to-table movement. So she was early on making a case for agriculture practiced without the use of synthetic pesticides and for crop rotation and for mixing livestock and vegetable and fruit farming and for foraging in the woods and for eating seasonally, both because you must in the pre-refrigeration South and because it tastes better. She was mounting a really strong case for flavor in cooking and for using what's at hand because it's going to be what tastes best. And that message, which really kind of first came out in The Taste of Country Cooking, which was her most famous cookbook that came out in 1976, was sort of buried for a really long time until the farm-to-table movement, as we know it today, kind of came into its own in the early 2000s, I think.
And the farm-to-table movement, which is kind of, I don't think, always associated with, you know, a Black woman who is the sort of matriarch of American cooking.
Of course not. Yeah. It is the whitest and the wealthiest kind of top-down movement that we've had. Well, I mean, I was going to say in food, but a lot of movements in food have come
that
out,
narrows
of
it
course.
Down.
So, so there's this current of subversion that kind of ran through her life. She was also working with the communist cause for a long time. Her husband was a communist organizer. She set type for the Daily Worker newspaper. Mm-hmm. And was deeply involved in politics throughout her adult life. And so if you kind of think about food as a way that people show up publicly in the world, but that it's just sort of, if you think about the way like mushrooms grow, for example, where they have all these winding roots that are going underground and maybe through trees, but you only see a little tip of them that sort of actually appears.
Absolutely.
I feel like in some ways, Edna Lewis's cookbooks are that for her.
They're
sort
cap.
Of her public life. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But she had all these other bits of her life and relationships and contexts that shaped her and shaped the way she thought about the world, many of which I think we still actually don't know
much she was
about.
Full human being.
She was a full human being and a pretty private human being, too.
I feel like a big part of your book was sharing, you know, so many different angles about her. There's so many different contributors who wrote so just beautifully from their perspectives. And do you feel it's important to reflect on all of these parts of a person when you're kind of putting their legacy in a book? Or do you think it's better to just focus on the work itself?
No, it's interesting now because I'm thinking about another life that I'm going to begin to start writing about. But I think when you talk about portraying someone's life only by the work they've done, you're basically talking about a patriarchal model of biography. And I think, you know, if we're going to start to change the structures around the ways that we talk about men and women and the kind of lives that they lead and the fullness with which those lives, you know, reach out in many different directions, you can't sort of just write a CV of somebody, you know, what they did, how much money they made, who they worked for, and the sort of laundry list of professional accomplishments. That actually doesn't tell you a whole lot about someone's life or their person. And so the way I approached the Anna Lewis book was that, you know, one, I'm a young white woman from New York, and I felt I had no right, both in terms of my own time and context. There's so much distance geographically, culturally, generationally between Anna Lewis and me. But also, I wasn't that interested in taking an authoritative stance on her because I didn't have one. I hadn't been deeply researching her life for years at the time. I never had occasion to meet her. I wasn't, you know, invested in her particular family or social relationships. So it seemed to me to make a lot more sense to reach out to people that did know her or who were really clearly inspired by her work in their own professional lives and have them speak to her power and legacy in their life and work. Because I think that starts to get at a little more what maybe is different about the way that women have always been in the world, which is that they tend, and not always, to live a little more relationally because they have to, because they don't have access to the same structures of power. So your power comes through relationship as a woman. And so I think part of writing about women's lives and telling women's story has to sort of inherently be different, particularly if you're talking about someone who was born at the turn of the century, in effect.
Absolutely.
Who was denied power on based on race and gender and class and the geography of the place she was born.
1,000%. I mean, I think one of the most interesting relationships she had, which was also an interesting relationship you had, was with Judith Jones.
Yeah, her editor.
Who's this other sort of big force in your own life.
Yeah.
And so Judith was Edna's editor. And then can you share about your experience with Judith and the time you spent with her?
Yeah. So Judith Jones was Edna Lewis's editor for her second, third, and fourth books. They did not do the first book together. But I was going to grandiosely say I came into Judith Jones's life, but let me flip that. Judith Jones very much came into my life. In 2012, I had just started a doctoral program, which is the other part of my life. I am an academic, even though I'm sort of hesitant to admit that sometimes because it feels a little archaic and dusty. But I had started a graduate program at NYU in food studies, and I was taking courses up at Columbia University because they have the preeminent oral history program really in the country, and they have one of the sort of teaching hub centers of oral history. And so as a student in New York, I had access to all those classes, and the director of the program was teaching that day, and it was a long class, and we took a break in the middle of a three-hour class, and she every week would get many, many inquiries from individuals and nonprofits and institutions that wanted to conduct oral histories but had no idea how to go about doing it. And so I happened to be standing at her elbow, literally, as she was checking her email. She was sort of not paying attention to the question I was trying to ask her. And she got an email from the Julia Child Foundation, who wrote saying, Judith Jones has just retired from Knopf in the past year. And we, as the Julia Child Foundation, Judith Jones was Julia Child's editor as well, are really invested in making sure that her history gets captured. And we'd like your assistance in figuring out how to go about collecting an oral history of her life and work. So I looked at that email over her shoulder. She sort of had looked up at me and said, oh, you're a food person. I'm always the odd food person in a room full of non-food
right time, right place.
Exactly. And I sort of committed the email address to memory and went right home and wrote them an email. I said, I have no idea what's going to happen with this project, but I think I want to be a part of it. This woman's my hero. And so sort of long story short, I started interviewing to be the lead researcher and interviewer on that project. I had originally thought maybe I'd be a research assistant or something, and maybe I'd get to meet the woman once. But they were really interested in having someone young and vigorous and hungry do the project. And so I was interviewed by the board members of the Julia Child Foundation, who I'm going to throw them under the bus here. At the time, were all white men.
Yeah.
But I was told, I was sort of offered some support to go do this project with the caveat that if I met Judith and she didn't like me, the deal was off.
That was said.
Wow. Yeah. And no uncertain terms. And it was described to me that Judith was rather prickly. She could be difficult to get along with. You know, she had, I think it was described to me as that brusque New England thing. And and so I sort of filed all that away and I called her up, which is what I was told to do. And she had been expecting my call, and she invited me to come have tea. This was in January of 2013. And so we did. I went to her apartment in the Upper East Side, which is where the same building she was born in and had lived in for most of her adult life. And we kind of hit it off right away. I mean, I was literally shaking in my boots. Mm-hmm. My palms were sweating tremendously. I have, like, no qualms about admitting how nervous I was.
And you said she was your hero. You, like,
absolutely.
Totally, like, you knew who you were talking to and the work she had done. And
I don't think I had a clue who I was talking to really at the time, but I had read her memoir, My Life in Food, The 10th Muse, My Life in Food. And that, I think for a lot of people, introduced them to Judith Jones and to her work in food specifically. And I was so sort of dumbfounded by this life of finding a way to be so interested and engaged in the worlds of words and food at the same time. And what it seemed to me very, very clear was that she had also found a way to sort of legitimize the worlds of women. And I didn't have words for that yet, but it was sort of, she had sort of quietly said that in her book without putting those words to it.
Yeah, interesting.
But I was drawn to it in the same way that I was originally drawn to Gourmet. This seemed like a life of adventure and of taking chances and of finding different ways to tell stories. So she agreed to meet with me again, and we sort of kicked off a six-month—
Second date.
Yeah, we had a second date. And we started meeting once a month with a tape recorder.
Yeah.
And I did a tremendous amount of research preparing for that project. I went and I read a lot of her old work correspondence in the archives, and I reread everything she'd ever written or that people had written about her. I mean, I really prepared for it as a sort of nervous historian.
Sure.
And then I put all my questions away, as you're sort of meant to do if you're actually going to have a real conversation with someone. And we would just talk. And it was remarkable to me. She was only a year retired at the time. She was 88 years old, which in and of itself is unbelievable. But she was just for the first time in her life slowing down enough to begin to reflect on what her life had meant and kind of putting things together in a different way than she had in other interviews or in her book. And I was rather amazed to find that there was maybe something about having finally left the working world or just having more time on her hands or having a different person. So again, we were more than 60 years apart asking her questions, that she was reframing kind of the way she looked at her life. And I was so taken with it. And it ended up becoming the basis for a doctoral dissertation. And it was sort of the genesis in some ways of my Anna Lewis work, and is also the genesis for a new book on her life that I'm beginning to work on now. It wasn't until I had been visiting with her for a couple of months that I began to think, there's a book or a movie in this. I mean, this is a woman whose impact on the publishing world is so enormous. And I think outside of the sort of food niche world, people don't recognize that this was a woman who was first and foremost a literary editor. She is responsible for rescuing the Diary of Anne Frank from the slush pile and having it published in English, which she did in 1950 when she was a secretary and living in Paris, working for Doubleday, that she was John Updike's lifelong editor, that she was Anne Tyler's lifelong editor, that she worked with John Hersey and Elizabeth Bowen and Langston Hughes. I mean, this is a woman whose impact, take out food entirely, her literary impact is tremendous. And that also that she came into publishing, she was hired in Knopf in 1957, when the founders, Blanche and Alfred Knopf, who were a couple, married couple, were still alive and had a very famously kind of contentious relationship with one another and the direction the publishing house should take. But Judith Jones was the only other female editor in the house when she was hired. And as she remembers it, she was almost always mistaken for a secretary because there just weren't women in publishing doing work as editors at the time. So to come in 1957, to have already sort of been responsible for something as big as the Diary of Anne Frank's publication, and then 4 years later, to be responsible for publishing Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which sort of broke America open in terms of its interest in cooking as creative pursuit, as a way of experiencing the world, as opening up, you know, what things can taste like, and also what women can do, right? That food doesn't have to be something stifling that keeps you at home, but can be a sort of key that unlocks the door to the world for you. That's remarkable. I mean, she was doing all this by the time she was in her mid-30s.
Wow.
And so I felt and still feel really compelled to share that story. It feels to me so timely in terms of the moment, political moment we're living in terms of conversations around women's role in politics, how we treat women in general. She was denied a raise in the 1980s because she was told by the editor-in-chief she had a husband who could support her. I mean, things actually haven't changed all that much. And yet she prevailed and had this incredible, incredible, incredible career. And meanwhile, she also had a life that feels so familiar to me, and I think will to lots of women, in that she was struggling to figure out how to be a working mother. They adopted, she and her husband adopted two children in the 60s. There were certainly no, there was no help from the publishing industry to make that possible for her. So she would stay up into the middle of the night working on her manuscripts. You know, there was no one helping her with childcare, helping her get out the door and things like that. She suffered from infertility. She had breast cancer as an older woman. So a lot of the things that I think women are grappling with that sort of we're sort of conditioned to keep our public and private lives so separate, she was having to figure out how to do all that at a time where there was no roadmap for any of this. And all the while was paying such incredible attention to women's stories and the kind of women's worlds of food and the space. I think in the same way we were talking about before, she gravitated towards the space of a kitchen because it seemed like where all the life was, where all the excitement was happening. And that was just a gut feeling for her. And it turned out to be a moneymaker in publishing.
Absolutely.
So there's something tremendous about that life and that story that I feel really compelled to bring to life.
And you had a personal relationship with her.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of time to really talk to someone and get to know them. Do you think it was, I'm just so curious about the sort of recording the oral history and getting to know someone so intimately towards the end of their life. Was it a two-way relationship? Was she asking you questions?
She started to, well, certainly that first meeting, which I think was very
much. Sussing you out.
Yes,
yeah.
She was trying to sort of scope out the caliber of my character, I think. And I remember we talked about three particular things. We talked about whether I wanted to get married, which seems like such a strange thing to ask someone, but she really valued her partnership with her husband, which was very, very long. And she wanted to know, I think she was trying to figure out if I was open to that kind of partnership in my life and work. We talked about travel and places we had been and, of course, what we ate. And she wanted to know if I used leftovers. It was very important to her and Julia.
I love it.
Sitting here with her. She wanted to know if I was the kind of person who could reinvent what was left over after, you know, cooking dinner and do something. She was... People talk about this who knew her. She was endlessly thrifty, who would do something creative with what was left and not be sort of what she thought of as abhorrently American and just toss it out and have to start something all anew.
She's a resourceful woman.
Very much so. But as we spent more time together, and particularly as we turned the recorder off after those 6 months and we continued to visit together, it just became more of a friendship. And I was so tentative about even calling her after that. I felt like I had sort of used up all my Judith Grace points, and I didn't know if she wanted to see me anymore. And it was actually a conversation with her stepdaughter who answered the phone one day when I called, who said, "Oh, Judith loves when you come." That I think our society is really quick to discard old women as irrelevant or not useful anymore, not
or
sexual
invisible.
Anymore. And she had so much life still to give. She was so energetic, but also this is a woman who had spent her whole life telling stories and helping people tell stories. And I think, much to her surprise, she was really delighted that people were finally starting to ask her about her own stories, which didn't happen until the very end of her life, really until she published her memoir.
And was she, because she had done her memoir, so I'm assuming there was sort of already a kind of a feeling of wanting to share about her life, but you know, being in the editor's seat for so long, helping other people tell their stories, was there any reluctance to kind of, to talk about these things, to answer any of your questions?
She was extremely reluctant to talk about the people she edited. She used the word sacred relationship around protecting those people and felt that what happened between author and editor was not for anyone to know.
Interesting. It's like a doctor patient.
Yeah. And on
which
one
kind of
our,
is.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely. That's right. You don't really want to know what goes on in the surgery, right? You want to know that it's okay in the end and that someone comes back pieced together. But I think she understood really deeply that what it meant to be a good editor was to be someone who had incredible kind of acuity and an instinct for relationship, and how you kind of delicately handle someone's story, which is so vulnerable, right? Whether it's a novel or nonfiction mm-hmm. or a cookbook, you're talking about something really personal to someone. And so she was not going to violate that by sort of gossiping about any of it. So she was keen to talk about herself. She was fairly open in talking about her marriage and her experience as a stepmother and an adoptive mother. But she really was so clear that she was absolutely not going to tell me about the ins and outs of what it was like to work with Anna Lewis or Julia Child mm-hmm. or John Updike or any of those other people. That wasn't for me or anyone else to know. Mm-hmm. And that was going to die with her. And it did.
Wow. And I guess all of those authors had already passed.
Yeah.
So she was holding on to that experience, just her side of it.
Yeah. Many of her authors have passed at this point.
Thinking about her as an editor mm-hmm. and that she is sort of in this ultimate control seat for these manuscripts and these books and the legacies of people like Edna Lewis and Julia Child, do you think, what kind of filter was she? Do you think a lot got filtered out of her authors, or was she an editor who sort of, you know, stepped out of the way, or was she very involved? Or
no. She had, I mean, look, I haven't been around in this world for all of that long, but there are plenty of editors that edit with a pretty light hand, mm-hmm. Either because they're too busy to do more, or they trust you, or they don't care to. Mm-hmm. She was as heavy-handed as they come. I mean, this is a woman who notoriously would show up at her authors' houses with manuscript pages if they weren't delivering on time. If it was a cookbook, they would often do days on end of recipe testing together so that she
famously
could make sure that the
Which
recipes
doesn't
were
happen.
No,
That's
of course
not. Like
not.
A thing.
No,
yeah.
I mean the idea now even seems ridiculous. Yeah. It seems like such a luxury of time, but also to have an editor that's invested enough in the project mm-hmm. to show up and who feels like they need to know that the process of the book coming together is as transparent to she, the editor, as it is to you, the author, I think is so rare. It was rare then, and it's even rarer now. But in that way, I don't know that we'll ever see her like again. And at her memorial service, some of her colleagues, even at Knopf, which is such a renowned publishing house, said the same, that yeah. her involvement and investment in her projects was tireless. I mean, she just knew every word back to front of every book she ever did, and was invested in the art that went into it, and the cover design, and how it was publicized, and the moment came out, in this sense that suggests to me that part of what was really singular about her is that she just had her eye on culture in general, and had a knack for timing, had a knack for what the kind of American appetite was going to be ready for at a given time, and also was comfortable pushing the envelope. You know, a lot of people said no one was ready for Mastering the Art of Cooking. Mm-hmm. Plenty of people said no one was ready for The Taste of Country Cooking, certainly. A lot of John Updike's fiction is considered really provocative, and certainly was when it was published. But she was always really comfortable saying, you know, something in my gut says this is a great story. Mm-hmm. This is going to resonate. And she would then put all of herself into bringing that book to life.
Yeah.
So in that way, she had the spirit, I think, of an artist. She really had this, like, the world needs to have this thing, and I am going to be its best ally.
Yeah. What do you think made her so invested? Why did she care so much?
That's a really good question. I don't know that I have an answer to the why, but anecdotally, in my own experience with her and in talking to people that worked with her and were in her family and friend group, she brought that care to everything except for cleaning. She just really cared about the world.
Yeah.
She was a lifelong churchgoer in the sense that she really protected meditative space for mm-hmm. herself, and liked listening, and liked the music that would sort of bounce around in the church walls. She would talk about the sort of magic of those acoustics. She always traveled with sort of wide eyes. She was someone who insisted on walking because she both wanted the exercise and wanted to see things at street level. She wanted to kind of experience how people lived in their day-to-day. So I think in some ways it was just a hunger for the world, and she wanted to work on books that reflected that accurately.
Yeah.
She was really not ever interested in the fantastical or in things that seemed bombastic at all. And I think, you know, in relation to her food work, she really didn't have any interest in working on professional chef or restaurant books. And that was the reason why, because they didn't reflect real life of people. She understood that that was performance or theater of a different kind. And she wasn't all that interested. I think she intuited that there was something different, that cookbooks could do something different. But even the way she talks about early on at Knopf being, she used the words, she was given a chance with Julia Child, that people thought it had no consequence. You know, let's let, I think she literally said to me that Alfred Knopf said, oh, let's let Mrs. Jones have a chance with this cookbook thing. No one thought it would have any impact one way or another. And so literally she could kind of go off to her office and make serious work out of this without anyone checking on her. And by the time they realized that she and it mattered, she was so invaluable, they would be crazy to let her go because it was something they could monetize as a publishing house. So there's something totally ingenious about that in a way, and like capitalizing on that feminine space and then sort of coming out the other side. And there's a little bit of a gotcha there, right?
Yeah, like, sort of amazing.
You know, we matter and I've made you some dollars over here.
Speaking about earning all these dollars for the publishing company, what was Judith's financial life like? Do you have any sense of that? Do you think she was compensated for this invaluable work she was doing?
No, not fairly.
Yeah.
And no, the answer is no. And the reason is the timing. And because there was no one that she could go to and compare notes with, really, right?
Interesting.
So even if she had had the courage, which she, at least in my speaking to her, she said she only once went in and asked for a raise and it was denied her. There was no one she could go to and say, well, what are you making? Because there was no one else. There was no one else doing cookbooks in the same way. There were so few women in publishing at the time. The women that started to come in came in as junior editors. She was already senior editor. So, right, it's apples and oranges in a way. You know, she died really comfortable. There's no question about it. But she didn't die rich. And she was an executive in publishing, and she should have died rich, right? As someone who worked for more than half a century and rose to the top of her game in a corporate industry.
And dedicated her everything to it.
Yeah. It's astonishing to me that she didn't die with an enormous estate. And there's no question that her male peers were making more than she did.
That's so interesting. Do you feel, you as a writer, and we could talk about this even together, do you feel like you have people you ask about these kinds of things, like in a way that Judith might not have?
I have just started to have the courage to. I don't know.
I mean, we talk about it a lot.
We do. Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard when you're starting out in any field to feel like you're worth anything monetarily, because the work culture that young people are kind of emerging into right now says you're not, right? The whole internship culture, which is that you have to work for free. I mean, I'm a college professor part-time. I'm astonished how many of my students put in 40 hours a week at unpaid internships for years, of like all 4 years of their college career. I feel like that's completely amoral. No one should work like that for no money. But that has got to get into your psyche a little bit. And I think, you know, I'm a half a generation removed from my students, but I think it's in mine too, the sense that, you know, I need more money than I get paid to make this work and make it good, right? Writing books takes a lot of time, whether they're cookbooks or prose books. But I'm scared to ask for it because I feel like, and I think a lot of my colleagues feel this way, I'd rather have some money than no money, or I'd rather have a book than no book. And my fear, definitely as a woman, is that someone's going to say, well, sorry then, no book deal. And that I would be so crushed by the rejection that I would rather take the lesser sum. And I'm trying to stop doing that because – one, I believe in writing. I believe in storytelling. And I think if we don't pay people to do it, the industries that support it are going to cease to exist. But also, you know, if someone is a good storyteller, if someone has a good story to tell, does it matter if they're 25 or 85? Like, should that have anything to do with it? And certainly questions of gender and race and class shouldn't have anything to do with it. But this idea that you have to climb the ladder as an artist or a storyteller, I actually think is kind of bogus, because the creative world doesn't work the same way as traditional industries where you kind of climb up in skill or you have to supersede someone else. Right. There's nothing linear about it. But I have a lot of discomfort around it. How do you deal with money?
I think money is so emotional, and I think it's fascinating. And I think creative work in general, and I think writing in general and I think recipes in general are all completely like undervalued. And I think we're all also, we've grown so accustomed to getting so much of this material for free.
Yes. And
I think, you know, we get it for free online. There is just so much. And I think with that, it becomes hard to be a consumer of it in a way. Like you don't always know what to read or what to trust. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really hard to be a producer of it too, because it's hard to know what it's worth.
Yeah.
And it's hard to have very clear conversations about that and to even know who to talk to. And I just think it's so important to talk about, because it's not just talking about our incomes, which are really important, and how we, you know, raising your children, buying
living
my dog's
life,
food,
paying,
paying her mortgage, all these things. And also, you know, put us in a position where maybe we can support other people, hire other people, that kind of thing.
Yep.
You know, it's so important, but it's also, it's the question of our own self-worth and value. And these are hugely important questions that, just as you said, it's also really particular, I think, to women. And then you bring in race and you bring in class, and it's like, it's a really big question. And I think the more transparent we all are, the better. And I think the more we can sort of work to lift each other up, because I think we also, it's sort of not talking about it puts us in scarcity mentality of like, there's, just as you said, like, well, they're going to take the book deal away.
Right.
And it's like, why can't there be more book deals?
Right. Right. And it's so pervasive too, because like, if you think about it, for most people, let's say you're working in books, not everyone works in book length, you know, or even written word for that matter, but let's talk about people writing cookbooks. So in that project, you have the primary author, you usually have an agent, you have a photographer, right? It's seldom that a food writer is also a food photographer. There are a few of those unicorns, but very few of us. You may have a professional recipe editor, and then you have the whole team at the publishing house that, if you're lucky enough to sell your book, has purchased it. So I think it's really intimidating, because you have to feel confident enough to sort of to encounter each of those people with a sense that you are worth enough to pay the people that you subcontract with, so your recipe tester and your photographer. You have to feel like you can make enough money on a book advance that you're not getting destroyed by giving your agent their 15% commission, which people don't like to talk about, but it's a reality, right? That's a huge chunk of money. But then I think there's this way in which the publishing industry also feels really intimidating and full of red tape, because, you know, they're corporate houses, most of them. There are lots and lots of people. You often interface with a lot of those different people at different stages in the making of a book. And so to not get intimidated at any stage and sort of be able to, you know, if someone gives you, say you get a great book deal, but then you're not supported in touring for your book, right? Which anyone who's written a book knows is the only way to actually sell a book, is to do a huge amount of legwork after publication. If your publishing house says, well, you know, nice book deal, but sorry, we're not going to support you as you are supposed to fly around the country or drive around the country and stay in hotels and eat meals. And if you have children, pay for childcare, right? Well, how are you supposed to do that? And if you don't have the confidence and the courage to go back to them and say, full stop, no, then I think there's this fear that lots of women, and frankly, a lot of young men have too, if they're new in the industry, about saying, you know, I'm worth this to you. If you thought my book was worth it, then I'm worth it now. And to sort of put up the fight, right? Be willing to sort of risk discord and unhappiness and, you know, that they may not want to publish your next book or whatever may happen. But I think for women in particular, and women of less privilege in particular, which is not my own experience, so I can't speak to it, but there's a sense that you have to be grateful for the little you get, so you can't ask for more, and that is bullshit.
My head is going to fall off because I'm just sitting here nodding, like, furiously. Totally.
But it's not going away.
Yeah, no.
I mean, I think women still almost speak to each other in that way. There's this guardedness when you first meet a colleague in whatever industry you're in, and, you know, mine happens to be food and food writing, where you have to kind of suss out someone else's moral compass and see if they're on the same page with you, because not everyone is.
Yeah.
So you can't immediately assume that another woman, even if she looks like you, even if she comes from a similar class background, has the same ideas around what she's worth or what you should be worth or what it's okay to ask for or what it's okay to say no to, right? Saying no is a huge part of it.
Huge.
So I think there's just, you kind of have to constantly be checking in with yourself and gather up a lot of courage. And I don't know that I have any words of wisdom about where you're supposed to get that from, because there's not a lot of precedent showing us that it can be done, frankly.
No. I wanted to talk about one more woman.
Oh, gosh. We've only done two of the three. Yeah.
Which is your mother. And you said something to me that I thought was really amazing. He said to me, the strange, paradoxical beauty of beginning my life as a, quote, food person while spending 4 years caring for my mom when she was terminally ill with pancreatic cancer. And I'm thinking so much about the intersection of food and hunger and desire and mm-hmm. all these things that come up with food and the intersection of all of that with a terminal illness.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty fascinating intersection. And as much as you're comfortable, I'm wondering if you could talk about that sort of paradoxical beauty.
Yeah.
And how that happened with your mom.
Yeah. I mean, I was literally a week into college when my mom went to the doctor for the first time in a series of appointments that led her and us to find out that she was sick. And I had gone to school in Massachusetts. I grew up in New York. And when I found out, I immediately called her and I said, I'm going to come home. My parents had been divorced for several years. My older brother was off at school and my mom was alone. And my mom was incredibly, incredibly self-sufficient, capable, independent person. But all of a sudden she was sick and I immediately assumed she was going to die. Her father had died of pancreatic cancer. He was old when it happened, so it wasn't tragic. But my association was pancreatic cancer. And frankly, cancer means death.
And it's a brutal pancreatic cancer. It's brutal.
Yeah. So I said, I'm coming home. You know, don't worry, I'll drop out. Who cares? I've just started here and I'll start again somewhere else. And she said, absolutely not, which was very characteristic of my mom. You're staying where you are. And so what I ended up doing was for the next 3.5 years, which was the entirety of my time in college, I traveled back and forth every other weekend and would take her to chemotherapy. And I would do the grocery shopping and I would pick up her prescriptions and I would hold back her wisps of hair while she threw up over the toilet and I would feed her for the weekend. And you know, this is maybe 3 or 4 years into only me getting interested in food at all and kind of starting to experiment on my own in the kitchen. And of course, I think like anyone who gets excited about a creative form at the beginning, you sort of initially get excited by the biggest or the tastiest or the most elaborate. So I wanted to make my mom the kinds of things that she used to like in restaurants, which were not fancy, but they were heavy and elaborate. Mm-hmm. So she loved moussaka. She loved fettuccine Alfredo, that staple of the 90s. You know, she loved a good roast chicken. And so I thought, of course, these are comfort mm-hmm. foods. This is what I will feed mm-hmm. my ailing mom because I hate to sort of fall back on stereotype, but when you're taking care of someone, whether it's as a parent or as a child or as a friend, all you want to do is feed them the things that are kind of going to bring them back to life and nourish them body and spirit. But she couldn't eat any of those things. Chemotherapy kind of destroyed mm-hmm. her sense of taste, and she was nauseous all the time. And the things that she wanted were things that by now I had developed a little bit of a snobbery mm-hmm. around, and I found disgusting. So what she wanted to eat was scrambled eggs cooked within an inch of their lives to like rubber. And she wanted to eat French toast made with like Wonder Bread, you know, the limpest of the limp white bread and was sort of soggy. And I was kind of appalled. And it took a year. My mom and I had a difficult relationship anyway. We're both strong personalities and stubborn people. It took a year of me trying to sort of force food down her throat that she literally couldn't eat or didn't want to before I kind of checked myself and realized this has nothing to do with me. And after a year of her being sick, and we in fact thought she was in remission for a short time, I think I realized how lucky I was to have my mom still alive. And if we were going to continue to have time together, I was going to shut up and sort of be at her service. And that was, I was 18 years old at the time. It was still, even having given birth to children, it was the most humbling moment of my life because it was being in service to someone entirely who I knew and we knew at that time was going to die anyway. So there was no sense that you're, you know, with a child, you feel like you're sort of bolstering them for the world, right? You're setting them off on a journey and fortifying their bodies. This is the opposite, right? You're sending someone out. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to give her things that were pleasurable, but that isn't what she could receive. And so we had to do something that looked really, really different. And it was horrifying for me that I would go back to Boston and, you know, in my downtime, I was sort of doing what I think people interested in food do. I was going to little grocery stores or discovering new little hole-in-the-wall restaurants and just being curious. And I would come home and I had to turn that off completely. And and kind of run this nursing home that was flavorless and increasingly sterile as she became sicker and sicker and as her body began to shut down. And I think it has ever since sort of helped me remember and really deeply in my bones know that all of the kind of fancy food stuff that gets tossed around on the media is like really utterly nonsense, because when you're actually taking care of someone using food, you have to do it in the humblest way possible, and you have to give them exactly what they want or need, which usually has nothing to do with what you want to eat and nothing to do with what's on the latest issue of Food and Wine or on the Food Network or, you know, coming through Instagram. It's a totally different level. Though I wish that my life hadn't gone that way, I wish I had more time with my mom and that she had been able to eat more heartily and with more gusto, it helped sort of quickly like scrub away any sense of elitism around what you should or shouldn't eat, or what it's okay to eat, or what is actually healthy. And I think we culturally have gotten really comfortable telling each other what we should or shouldn't eat for wellness or for coolness or for cachet or for whatever you're trying to demonstrate. And that actually taking care of people and feeding them doesn't look a thing like that.
It's not performative.
No.
Yeah.
No. And it may not even necessarily be delicious.
Yeah.
And that's not really what it's about. It's about literally feeding someone, literally nourishing them. It's funny now, I have 2 2-year-olds and they now in some ways are interested in the kind of what people call the all white toddler diet. You know, they want buttered pasta and chicken nuggets and things. I swear I would never feed my kids. Here it is again. It's happening again.
Yeah.
But you got to let your kids eat, right? And you're going to let, if you want them to eat. And she kind of wanted the all white diet too. Mm-hmm. You know, is that like yellow, white,
beige palette. I was going to ask if there was a parallel.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, the only difference that I can tell with toddlers, my toddlers eat better than my mom did when she was sick, frankly, in terms of eating more, because
just
they're
quantity,
growing
you
like
mean.
Weeds, yeah. constantly yeah. eating. And also because there's a sense of joy around it. And though I'm grateful that I was able to help care for my mom when she was dying, it was not joyful.
No.
It was tragic. She was 54 when she died.
That's so young.
And God, she had been healthy before that. So no, it felt like there was no justice there. It was, even though I changed the way I was feeding her, there was resentment threaded through all of that. There's no question. I wish I was the kind of person who could have totally put it aside, but I couldn't. I was too angry about losing my mom.
Like, understandably.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah. What were you eating at that time?
What was I eating? We ate, my brother, when he came home and when I was home, were eating an exorbitant amount of takeout, frankly, because so much of our energy was going into taking care of someone who's sick is a lot like taking care of a baby. I mean, there's not a lot of space for trying to prepare a separate meal, right? You often hear young parents talk about not wanting to prepare 2 dinners. Well, we didn't either. And even if we weren't cooking delicious food, we were cooking for mostly me, but sometimes my brother, were cooking for my mom and endlessly washing sheets. You know, she was ill, so they were constantly, yeah. constantly pajamas and sheets and clothes, and she couldn't do any of that stuff for herself. She had a dog, so we were walking the dog. So we were eating like a lot of chicken teriyaki from the place that we grew up ordering from. And one of the things that I actually really enjoy remembering about that time in my life is that I reconnected with the things I loved to eat as a kid, none of which had any connection to like a big city or a big chef. So we had a bagel shop. It was a perfectly good bagel shop. And I just remember on the stressful days going and getting a bagel with cream cheese and lox, and it was the best thing in the world, and some crappy coffee with milk and sugar in it. You know, it was really elemental comfort food. And the other really beautiful thing that happened during that time was my mom was really, really reclusive. And she spent her entire adult life working with autistic kids, most of whom were nonverbal. So she wasn't a talker, and she worked with non-talkers, which is so amazing to me. And maybe in some ways as her daughter made me more of, I wanted to talk with her and she didn't want to talk, which maybe is why I'm a writer now. But my mom was so reclusive and didn't have a lot of friends outside of the school that she had worked at for several decades at that point. But a lot of the friends, I grew up in a small town and we lived there my entire life in the same house. And my friends' parents wanted to help in some way. And they knew from years of just sort of being around me and my mom just peripherally that she wasn't someone who was going to welcome people into the house bringing food. So we set up a cooler system where they would drop off meals on the back porch in a cooler and she could come out and get them if and when she was ready. But no one ever came in. No one even knocked. And I was floored. That went on for more than 3 years.
Wow.
That people that essentially had no relationship with my mom other than the relationship they had with me through their children were feeding her. Again, it's like whenever it's tempting to get carried away with the sort of frivolous part of food or the perfectionism of it, then there's that.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of people just bringing food to one another and showing up. And none of that was fancy food either. You know, it was just what they were making for their own families. And they made a second pan of it, or they had cooked too much spaghetti sauce and they put some in the freezer and brought it over one night. And that literally sustained my mom. I mean, literally sustained her life for more than 3 years.
It's unbelievable.
It's really humbling.
Yeah. And it sounds like the people who are doing that in giving that food to your mom, they were also taking care of you. They were doing it because of you.
I think that was, they felt a need to step in because they were aware that I wasn't getting a lot of parenting at that point. My dad was very much still in my life, but he didn't live in the same town and they knew I was going back and forth from school. And it was something they could do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing all of that. I have one just fun question that I love asking everyone. And you kind of touched on this earlier, so I'm wondering if my guess is your answer. Anyway, what was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
You might be disgusted. every Tuesday, my mom had a work meeting late.
Okay.
And so she'd come home and prepare the simplest thing she could, which was buttered spaghetti, hot dogs fried up in a frying pan, and frozen corn kernels, which is
the opposite of disgusting.
Something that, like, I feel like I should be a little ashamed to say. I love that meal. It is in no way balanced or like goes against a lot of the ethoses I have around food. But it was my favorite thing to eat as a kid, and it's probably still one of my favorite. I love hot dogs.
I
love hot dogs.
I get it. And then cooked in a pan like that.
Yes. Yeah. You got to get – I'm not a boiled hot dog person. I want that like browned, crunchy snap thing.
Totally.
Yeah.
I get it. Sweet, salty, the corn in the pot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that sounds great.
Yeah.
Totally
Tuesday
great.
Tuesday dinner.
Tuesday dinner. Did you call that meal anything? Just Tuesday dinner.
I don't think so. No, I don't even think we called it Tuesday dinner. It just showed up on the plate.
Before we get to our listeners' questions, a quick word about OXO, who helped make this episode possible. Why do I have so many OXO tools in my kitchen? It's because I trust them and they're reliable, and they help my work as a cookbook author be dependable and accurate. They also help my time as a home cook feel much more relaxed. I appreciate OXO's commitment to make every day better, every day. They approach their tools just like I approach all of my recipes. They notice things and solve problems and see opportunities to improve the process. Like their small citrus juicer, which I honestly can't live without. Perfect for one lemon. It catches the seeds and everything, and the juice goes directly into a measuring cup that has a spout. It's so handy. Thanks, OXO, for supporting Keep Calm and Cook On. Want to check out OXO's products? Just head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. And now for listeners' questions. If you have a question for me, just send me a DM on Instagram at Tertian or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. And I have to say, it's been so fun to get emails in that inbox. And guess who is sitting next to me?
Hey, Julia.
Hey, Grace.
Ready for a question?
I'm ready.
Okay, your first question comes from Eating Reading. They recently received a Dutch oven as a gift, and they'd like to know if you have any good go-to recipes for a Dutch oven.
So Sarah actually just wrote a piece for the Washington Post, and I'll include it in the show notes, about the chicken that she and her husband make all the time, and it sounds so good. And they put a whole chicken in a Dutch oven, put it in a hot oven for like half an hour until it gets brown. And then they add water, I think like halfway up. They cover it and they turn the heat down like really, really low and let it cook overnight. And it makes like the most delicious kind of like pull apart chicken and really, really rich broth. So I will definitely include that because I think it sounds awesome. And I use my Dutch oven all the time to make a sort of quicker chicken where I brown like bone-in pieces of chicken, add a bunch of vegetables, and then just a little water or stock and let it simmer. And it's just a braised chicken and vegetables. It's done in like 45 minutes start to finish and so delicious.
Your next question comes from Elizabeth in Belgium, who's a journalist and would like to know, how can we write better stories about food?
I'm very excited to hear that there's a listener in Belgium. I think this is a really important question. I could do a whole show about this, you know, with people who I think are writing really amazing stories about food. But for a quicker answer, I would say we have to ask ourselves two really important questions. One, whose story isn't being told? And two, are you the right person to be telling it? And I think if you feel you are, you know, I know for myself, when I feel that feeling, the thing I try to do is to make it not only personal, so it really comes across in a strong way, but then also make it not about me. You know, what can someone take away from this that applies to their own community, their own life? You know, how can you make something personal broader?
Your next question comes from quite a handle. It is MMP87SLC. I'm guessing Salt Lake City. They're curious, what is your weekly meal prep and what does it look like?
I want to start an Instagram handle that's called quite a handle. Our weekly meal prep, I feel like it always kind of looks a little bit different and it's not that routine. And I feel like the reason it's not is because I love grocery shopping. I go grocery shopping all the time, like probably every other day or so. And Grace, you also enjoy grocery shopping. So we're always picking things up and kind of using what we have. But I would say for the most part in our fridge, there's always some cooked greens like kale or collard greens, something like that. There's usually some type of salad dressing or sauce. Lately, I've been doing a lot of like tahini and yogurt mixed together with some lemon juice. You know, things you can sort of use as building blocks to build meals. So not so much weekly meal prep, but a few kind of staples that we kind of use throughout the week.
Your last question comes from Dakota Ewan, who's looking for tips on building flavor without garlic or onion because they can't eat them.
I would suggest trying some other aromatic vegetables, things like fennel and carrots and celery. You can dice those and saute them, and they can make a similar base the way, you know, sauteed onions will in like a soup or a braise or just about any dish. And when it comes to garlic, you know, substituting something for that, I would just say don't forget the power of spices. And especially when you cook spices briefly in hot fat, like oil or butter or ghee, something to just really get them going, get all their flavor out. And, you know, those things will take you a long way. Thanks so much, Grace.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you coming back on. I know where to find you. If you have a question for me, just send me a DM on Instagram at Tertian or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. I'll see if I can get Grace to read your question, and I can't wait to answer it. Thanks for listening to Keep Calm and Cook On. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast and rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. Also, tell a friend or a family member. Text your mom or your cousin or your old roommate. Let them know. Also, if you have a cooking question that you'd like to hear me answer, just drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. That's keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. For more information about me and the show, head over to juliatertian.com. Everything about my work is there, and if you click on Keep Calm and Cook On, you'll find everything about the show. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Tertian, which is just my last name. Thanks again to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. And before I really say goodbye, a quick shout out to an organization that I feel is using food to move us all forward in a positive direction. This one is near and dear, literally, to both Sarah and myself. It's the Kingston YMCA Farm Project. They describe themselves as an urban educational farm, and they're right in Midtown Kingston, New York. They have a beautiful organic farm behind the YMCA, and they sell the produce at their stand in the Y and throughout the city of Kingston. What's so cool is that they involve kids in the farm, including a group of teenagers in their youth development program that they employ through the farm. It's hands-on and it's making a difference, and it's an amazing model for so many communities. To learn more about them, head over to KingstonYMCAFarmProject.org. Thanks again for listening to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'll catch you next time.